G'day folks, talk to Lee Chambers, an environmental psychologist in Picton, in the UK, United Kingdom, England, and had a yarn about his life and journey, where it all started out with him and his entrepreneurial skills as a gaming distributor, where he started out in that sector and where that ended up gravitating into Essentialize, into his functional life coaching, environmental psychology. But in between that, where he had a bit of adversity, where he's got an autoimmune disease, and where that left him in the position of where he couldn't walk, and how he dealt with that, and where he is now. It's great yarn. I want to thank our sponsors, Permobil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here, and they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, let's get into it.
Keep rolling with Jake Briggs.
Oh, yeah. Happy days, we're rolling.
Let's go.
Righto, Lee Chambers. Well, mate, thanks for, you know, reaching out and us having a yarn across the web, coming from, you know, going from Australia over into the UK. And first and foremost, mate, so you're the founder of Essentialize Functioning Life Coaching and also Phenom Games, mate, which I'm excited to jump into both and the aspects of both individual organizations and how you fit into both, mate. But yeah, again, mate, thanks for, yeah, open up the webcam and decided to have a yarn with us. And yeah, mate, let's get the ball rolling, eh?
Super, yeah, it's a pleasure to be on, Jay. Thanks for inviting me.
So, mate, if you want to jump into, I don't know which came first, if it's Phenom Games or, you know, the importance, well, I shouldn't say the importance, but really I think it's from what I see, like one of the main structures of what you run with what you got in the background there, which is Essentialized Functional Life Coaching. And that seems like it's a pretty big component of your life and what you run, mate. And if you want to either jump into if it's Phenom or if it's Essentialized, mate, and just take us through a bit of the journey. Well, it seems like what you've been, what, over a decade with the functional life coaching and been in that field.
Yeah. So best thing to do is start at the beginning, because my journey explains the businesses and the reasons, and that kind of helps expand and unpack it in a way that people can understand. Because when people look and see a video game company, a wellbeing company, seems like a long bridge to cross.
And yeah.
Already extrapolates that out and helps people understand why I've navigated the world in that way and why it's come to that. So yeah, I grew up in the UK, working class parents. They both worked really hard. I was always quite disruptive and curious as a child, but also quite academically talented. And parents recognised that quite young and really tried to push me towards university, because no one in my extended family had ever been. So they wanted me to go and in some ways pave the way, and show that anyone in the future of our family can also go into university and go and succeed in education if they so desire, and if that's, you know, something that they want to do. So I had a relatively stable childhood. You know, we always had food on the table, roof over our heads. And I then went off to university and really enjoyed it. The first period, you've got freedom, autonomy of choice, and all of a sudden a whole wide world to go into. And I found that liberating.
And what did you jump into with university, mate? Like, what did you start studying when you jumped? And
I started studying international business psychology. Mm-hmm. And the reason behind that was I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And what international business psychology did was had a very wide variety of units that you would undertake for your degree. So there was units in geopolitics, units in language and communication, units in organizational psychology, and finance and accounting. And there's quite a wide variety.
That's pretty varied. Yeah.
Yeah. And that kind of, that's always been a bit of a trend in my own life where I really don't like going into isolation on something so deep that you start to neglect the basics and you're chasing after more complex problems when in reality, us as humans and the world itself is so interconnected. You come up with solutions by looking at all the things it affects rather than trying to solve the one thing that you narrowly focused on. So that kind of fulfilled that criteria. But in my second year at university, I started to struggle a little bit. So like anything, like as a millennial, my childhood had been relatively stable. I hadn't had many significant challenges, massive barriers to overcome, or really faced any significant trauma. So I wasn't really that prepared to make that adolescent to adult transition. But more so, my dad, he was always out working. So I hadn't really had much of a deep relationship with him. It was very much like surface level communication.
Okay.
And kind of what that did is...
Was mum at home?
Yeah, so mom, yep. My mum was out working as well.
Yeah.
Quite often, you know, I was looked after by my grandparents here, and one parent there while the other one was working. But unless it was, you know, the holidays, didn't always spend that much time. And I have two younger brothers as well. So the attention was, you know, again, shared across three of us. Mm-hmm. And given that there was a time when my mum was working for three jobs, my dad was working 12 hours a day, I'd quite often end up taking myself off to church on a Sunday morning and things like that. I remember that it's not necessarily that they weren't there, it's like they worked so hard that they didn't really have much to give in terms of deeper conversation. Mm. What that kind of did for me is meant that I hadn't really evolved my own, navigating my own emotions. I'd not really built any self-awareness. I didn't really have a defined idea who I was authentically and what masculinity was for me. Because
okay.
I didn't really have a great example from my father. I looked out to society. People who look and seem like me were in the sporting arena or in the entertainment arena. And I was more of a scientist, an entrepreneur, someone who liked data and statistics, someone who liked helping people. And I looked at it and I thought, I can't really see that out in society as someone that looks like me, who sounds like me, who thinks like me. And then so I need to go into myself. And what I found is I didn't have the tools to dig deeper.
And what were you finding when you were young? Like when you were growing up, you know, whether it was with your grandparents or whether it was with mum or dad or with your other siblings, with, you know, where you're growing and what you like, you're the into science, you like statistics, you like everything that's around that. So where were you grabbing inspiration from when you were a young fella? So was it your open environment? Was it what you were seeing through, like as a millennial, because you would have, if you had like access to computers or if it was watching shows or certain teachers at school? So where were you dragging some of that early inspiration from?
Yeah. So if you kind of look back, I was born in 1985. So as a younger child.
Me too.
Hey.
There we go.
So as a young child, when I was, say, five, you know, I mean, it was 1990, very early days of technology. And it wasn't something that my parents really had any acuity to. And what kind of happened is my inspiration came from my uncle. So my uncle was a very early adopter of PCs, of programming, and of computers and data. So he's autistic and he's very, very, his niche interest is computers. So he is older than my mum, and him and my mum were both adopted. And their parents, their adopted parents were much older when they adopted them. So they both passed away before I was even born. But my mum and my brother kind of they stayed in contact because ultimately they had each other in a lot of ways. And my uncle, he bought me a Commodore 64. So
old school.
He introduced me to computers, and that gave me a segue into that world where all of a sudden I was able to start to look at these, you know, these newer technologies that were expensive at the time and not accessible for a lot of people. So even in school, we had a BBC and that was it. Time was incredibly limited to use it, but I had a device at home. And yet it took about 25 minutes for a tape to load to play anything. But that gave me a chance to kind of express that. And what I found is not only did I resonate with it a lot, but I quite enjoyed it. And it was something that I then moved on because he then bought me an Amiga 1200, which then opened up the capacity for me to do more things, to start to learn word processing and spreadsheets. But that also actually
started. So you're into that from a young age when it's got to do with spreadsheets, word processing, all of that.
Yeah. So again, I'm like, we're probably talking 9, 10.
Really?
Doing these kind of things and you're not doing them at school yet. So in some ways, you're kind of like an early adopter.
Mm.
But if I kind of look now, what that's given me is a real technological agility because it changes so rapidly. And yet I was doing it from such a young age. How I kind of see it is today's like Gen Z, they've been steeped in technology since they were two. it is just that to them. But that has given me a certain like technological agility. That was kind of where I started to feed into not only some of my more curious and disruptive side. I ended up posing as an 18-year-old and advertising in magazines. Amiga magazine, selling Amiga games and then mail ordering them as a 12-year-old. So I've always
started early.
Yeah, I've always been a little bit crazy like that. And I was a kid who I found a shop that was selling sweets and candy very close to its expiry and then filling a bag full and taking it to school and selling it until I got pulled because apparently you can't do that without hygiene certificates and all that kind of stuff. But also, it was getting to the point where that bag was bigger than my school bag and it looked like I was carrying a mobile shop around with us, literally.
Jeez. So, you had business acumen before you even hit high school, pretty much.
Yeah, and I kind of think, if I look at it, it wasn't necessarily business acumen, but the willingness to step out there and try it, you start to learn things that you simply don't learn by not doing, and you don't learn in education.
Yeah, so just trial and error.
Yeah, so trial and error, but also taking action to chisel what works and what doesn't. Mm. Starting to understand, obviously margins and how to advertise and what words get people buying and what people don't. So you start to learn little bits of marketing, little bits of finance, and little bits of entrepreneurialism. Just by doing, it's very hard to distill those things into some kind of educational format and then try and send you out there to the world with business models because business is incredibly unpredictable and complex. It's very difficult to fit it into those models. So if we kind of then fast forward back to university and I was going through these challenges and I started to struggle. I had a presentation in front of 300 other students, got halfway through and then choked and froze. And my fellow student then stepped in and finished off my part of it. But again, that knocked my confidence a bit.
Was it just anxiety? Anxiety and everything else, like the whole mental aspect that kicked in or?
Well, what happened when I look back now and, detach the emotion from the whole situation is I hadn't prepared enough. So in a lot of ways, I went for education being quite academically gifted. That also meant that I was also academically lazy. So I didn't have to do much revision, didn't have to go too deep into topics, and I still came out with the grades. Hence, I went for education, and I really floated along, taking it for granted that I'd be all right.
Okay.
But then it gets to a point where you have to dig that bit deeper, and complacency sets in. And I went into that presentation, not as prepared as I should have been. And even one of the girls I was presenting with has said, look, you're not taking this seriously enough, are you? And I was like, ah, we all right. Yeah.
But that's pretty daunting, though. 300 people, that's going to put a lot of people off, you know, when they're front and center. And if it's whatever they got to talk about, you know, if they know it or they don't, even if you're going over it multiple times, that can be pretty daunting to a lot of individuals out there, unless they step, you know, dip their toes in a couple of times and taste it. Some individuals can crack it straight away, but yeah, so you fell short in that instance, but it doesn't sound like you'd ever fall short of that again.
I had that, and then I've joined lots of societies and clubs, and that was great initially. But then as a person, I tend to get quite a lot of my energy from just being with myself. So I was really pushing the boundaries of my own activity. It started to burn me out a little bit, but then that kind of recycled backwards. So I actually started to isolate myself more than was productive for me. So I started to avoid going out and seeing people. And then my own self-care started to take a bit of a spiral downwards. Basically, I just wasn't looking after myself. And because I wasn't able to access who I felt a bit stuck.
Is he still in university? Is this his stage of life in uni still? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so I'm being stuck there just led me to avoid even more. I effectively put my head in the sand and hope that something was going to come along and bang, I'd be able to, you know, navigate my emotions better and understand and express myself better. And it actually led me to isolate myself in my dorm for 2 weeks. I missed a few exams. And then obviously my parents got the phone call. He's like disappeared. My parents came to my dorm, took me home. And
really?
That was the first real trench I fell into in my life. So I faced a big challenge, defining myself and expressing myself. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't find a way.
Yeah.
So instead of trying to find a way and approaching it, I avoided it and fell into the hole. So my parents came, took me home, and I then had to reflect.
So what was it avoiding? Was it not just like you got university and obviously you got the academic proponent, but then you've got, you know, the classes that you're going to, but the people that you talk, that you have to talk to and engage with, was that the big component of it there?
Yeah, so it was kind of the fact that I knew that struggling was not how I identified myself. When you go through education and you keep being told you're clever, you're doing well, you're gifted, you're this and that, when you start to struggle, you feel like you're failing. You feel like you're a failure. And I knew that I had to find a way to express myself. But firstly, I was failing my identity as it was now. I wanted to change that identity and move to who I actually truly was. But I found the road blocked and knew that the more I put myself out there, the more it drained my energy, but also the more, realistically, the questions would come that would probe me and dig me deeper. And yeah, I didn't want to face that at the time. I didn't want to face the questions about why you're struggling, why you're not coming out. It's a perpetuating spiral. It's kind of like the, really, in many ways, the elements of depression then increase your loneliness, and then your loneliness increase your depression, and you continue to isolate in a spiral because you don't want to step out, and it feels hard.
It's so true. Yeah, the more you don't face your stuff, and you know, because there's with the struggle and sacrifice, that if you don't dip your toes in and taste the fear, or just where you try and face what, you know, some of the stuff that you initially were going through, that's exactly what you said. That's when it can compound and spiral, and unless you face these certain facets of life that come at you, like it's just going to bury you deeper.
Yeah. And to that point, when my parents took me home, what it actually did is it suddenly gave me the space and took me out of the pressure cooker.
Okay.
Just removed that. So I was taken away, wasn't attending lectures, wasn't any pressure to go and see people. And I just had time to sit there and reflect and think, what's happened? How have I got to this point? And I realized that I started to see it more clearly. Instead of approaching it, I've just been avoiding it. I kind of said, right, so I need to approach it, but I need to start to think how I'm going to do that. So I started to reflect on the past, but taking the emotion the way I started to realise on that stage, I hadn't failed. It wasn't me who was a failure. I hadn't prepared. I'd failed to prepare. Lee wasn't a failure. And when seeing that, it allowed me to start to unpick some of the other elements of my life.
And what does prepare, and you're talking about, you're saying prepare. So what does prepare mean to you? Like what if it's got to do with that younger Lee that's on the stage, or where it's sort of conceptualized to what you've got going on now?
Yeah, so I mean, prepare for me was to be fully understanding of what you're going into, actually make a plan to be able to deliver and execute on what you plan to do. So for that particular speech, I had some element of practice in it, refining it, going over it again, getting those elements of repetition in, and also practicing more with the people who I was delivering it with. Because what I'd done is they'd met as groups to practice delivery. And I'd just been like, I'd only attended like half of them. The others, I was like, oh, it'll be all right. I don't need to keep going to these. I can do my own stuff. And in reality, in life, preparation, it's vital, because you don't really know what's going to happen in the moment. And yet, if you've got a vision of how it's going to be laid out, you practice to a point where you've got some congruence with what you're doing, then that allows you to be more resilient in those moments. Like, I might still have had that moment, but I'd have been able to pick back up again. I wouldn't have gone completely off. And we all have these challenges in life. Anxiety and our fight or flight mechanisms, our parasympathetic nervous system.
Yes.
It can do some crazy things at crazy times. Life isn't, it's not smooth sailing.
And it's just crazy, especially what upstairs, like what goes on mentally and what's swimming around in the brain and in that inner atmosphere, and how that can physically, not just mentally, and that can put you on in a different place, but physically what it can do to you also. And then
psychologically and physically, incredibly interconnected.
That's right.
But yeah, and then kind of like looking, and I realized that I started to see that I'm gonna have to approach this. But I'm going to need to think about, firstly, I looked out to society. Looking out to society isn't going to help me find me. It's just going to help me find someone else. And I can model them, but that's still not really me. Mm. And really, my relationship with my parents, it is how it is. It's up to me to start to build my own self-awareness, start to understand how to navigate my own emotions. Like, I'm at university studying units of psychology, but not really applying it because I'm not taking it seriously. I'm just studying it. And I thought, you know what? You're learning this stuff. Start to try and apply it to yourself. Start to try and build your own self-awareness. That's the only way you're going to be able to access a deeper level of yourself that you can then go and express authentically.
Yeah. So
I started that process, and having the space at home was really helpful. Helpful enough that I got myself back to a place. My confidence was still quite low, and yet my awareness was higher. And I went back to university and took it more seriously. I prepared. I did my final year. And again, I was almost in some ways undercover. So I wasn't out and about doing everything like I was before. I just went back to uni, focused on my studies, planned, prepared, did what I needed to do, and graduated, and felt a lot better for it because I knew I'd overcome that challenge and managed to finish.
So was that the foundation base of really where self-awareness really started to impact with yourself in that last year of uni, and where you graduated and now it's starting to simmer and grow into the next process of life? Is that correct?
Yeah. So that kind of like, in so many ways, the education system is like, right, so write down the answers on this piece of paper. Right, they're correct. Right, you can move on to the next phase of life. I didn't need that. I needed to understand yourself more.
Yeah.
Can you navigate that? Can you express that? Okay. Then you can move on to the next phase of life. That was what growth was for me, not writing down some answers.
And were there also outside pressures also? Like, you've now got your pressure on yourself, but also you, you're, you're talking about, yes, you're academically gifted, but then you're the one that's pushing the boundaries for your family, as in getting over the line when it's got to do with university. There's that pressure. And were there other outside pressures from, if it was other friends or other elements like that in tow?
To be honest, most of that pressure was internal. So again, when you kind of like become the bastion for education in your family, there is that element of pressure and that expectation. And also prior attainment creates expectation. Mm-hmm. And then it's difficult because, again, when I start to look at how I'm wired, like I have autism, I have Asperger's. So I have a fixed mindset, you know, equity mindset. And it's very, very difficult to work on that for me. I've practiced a lot over the years. But because of how I am neurologically, it's challenging. So I very much had that identity of, you know, high achiever. I wasn't achieving. And that suddenly then creates a lot of pressure because you suddenly have that dissonance from your identity to reality. And it's not easy to accept that if you're very much anchored into that's who you are and suddenly not living anywhere near the level that you set for yourself. Mm-hmm. And obviously now, as an adult who's been through a hell of a lot, I'm able to look back and realize that actually you just need to accept your identity is not fixed. It's very much flexible and flowing. It's continually evolving, growing, stretching and changing. And yet at that time, I didn't have access to any of that. And again, a lot of the realms of development stuff, they weren't talking about these things. And I wasn't in those realms because I was too busy stuck, really, just entertaining myself when I was younger, because there were so many novel things that we could do in, you know, in the late 90s. Because everything that was, technology was moving so quickly. And all of a sudden, you know, we went from like 3 television channels to 200 and there's just so much going on.
And that's a important component of who you are, brother. Like, and just talking about brothers, like my youngest brother, he's got Asperger's syndrome as well. So, and you know, me and as an older brother, like I'm 3 years older than him, just knowing from, and this is me and as an outsider, looking at, so I've always grown up with disability and known it. Like I've got an acquired disability. I'm just over a decade being a quadriplegic, but me just looking at my youngest brother and just knowing just his look on life and just the functionalities of that and who that and the makeup of what Asperger's syndrome is and just how difficult it can be, but also, you know, the negatives and the positives that you get from both. And that's a massive makeup of who you are as a person, and just sort of, and that's interesting, you know, because just talking to you now and then talking about Asperger's, autism and disability and just you talking about that self-awareness aspect and looking out on the rest of the world, that's huge when it comes to what, because I'm just thinking you know what it's like with the stereotypical autism, Asperger's, and you know, dealing with people and dealing with that self-awareness factor and just what you're diving into, that's out of the that's outside of what the typical realm of what Asperger's is when it's jumping onto platforms and talking to people and being engaged in that aspect of life.
And I kind of think that's because initially it was difficult. There wasn't the awareness when I was younger around it. And what kind of happened was not having that awareness meant that I wasn't aware and I was trying to push myself to be neurotypical. And that also led me to then struggle because I was pushing way beyond the boundaries that I could tolerate over time.
And did you understand what it was back then, like with autism, Asperger's? No.
So again, I've not really got more clarity until I've become an adult. and my own son has been diagnosed recently. And that has really opened up things for me even more, because I can, again, when you see it through someone else's eyes, it also, you know, becomes, because it's, we're so blinded by our own lenses.
Yeah.
That, like you say, with you, with your brother, it gives you a different, you know, a different vantage point. And me with my son as well, that's almost helped me to start to understand and navigate myself that little bit better. So I'm having to navigate my own, you know, communication and parenthood with him. So yeah, I mean, I now feel that I'm trying to, in so many ways, show that as a young black male who has Asperger's, that you don't need to be limited to the jobs that people think that you should be limited to. Like, it's really far outside my comfort zone to stand on a stage and talk to people and to communicate with people very deeply on a regular basis. That has taken me a long time to really, you know, to really harness that and the emotional intelligence to build that. It's not something that has ever come naturally to me. And yet I feel that I need to be in some ways expressing that this is something I want to do. But also I want to show that you don't need to be you don't need to conform to what society says you are if you've got Asperger's, that you're likely to be a computer coder in a dark room working incredibly, you know, powerfully, but not connected to the world, because
It's like, stop watching Mercury Rising and some of those other movies that just show this is what people that are on the autism spectrum are like. Like, you know, there's, change is inevitable, and there's all different facets to autism, and that's what a lot of people don't realize. And it's, and look at, you know, the person that you are.
And I think that, to be honest, if we went down the pathway of how disability is communicated, how boundaries and limits are placed by society, even by professionals, we'd probably have a whole 5-hour long form podcast.
I was going to say, that's for the next one, mate.
So that's for the next one. But to then kind of expand, I've then graduated and it's 2007. So I have to then sit back and think, right, what do I want to do? So I kind of look at and reflect back on things that I enjoy, things that resonate with me. The two things that really stand out are data and statistics and playing with money and figures and helping people. And that's something that's kind of like woven through all the experiences that I've enjoyed, the friends that I've made, the things that have, you know, that have been part of my life so far. So I put them together, mix them up, and then think, right, so figures helping, I'll go and be a financial advisor, because I can help people with the financial well-being and I can get my hands dirty on the lovely figures, percentages, statistics, compounding interest, and have a whole lot of fun with that. So I kind of then anchor into that and think, that sounds like a really good idea, because that seems to be ticking all the boxes for me. So off I go into the interview processes for a few different national banks here in the UK, and I managed to get on a financial advisory graduate scheme.
Nice.
Which is great. And I'm like, I'm over the moon and I'm happy. And I go and I work really hard for 6 months, because they take quite a lot of graduates on, knowing that there's going to be another wave coming in 9 months.
So would they put you through like a grad program, and then you'd learn the different facets of the company and the financial aspects of that and how it works?
And they would fund all my financial advisory professional qualifications. So this sounded like the plan for me. But if we just go back again, this was 2007 in the autumn when I graduated. Not the best time to graduate and go into finance, because 6 months later...
GFC!
6 months later, the economic crash really bites, and all of a sudden, lots of people above me are packing the desks up. And I'm like, it doesn't seem good. So I get pulled in by my manager and he says, your professional qualifications, you're pulling the funding. So unless you can pay for them yourself, it's just the external circumstances. I'm sorry.
It was scary times.
And I'm like, that doesn't seem fair. Like, but then I kind of thought to myself, well, at least I've still got a job. And then a few weeks later, got pulled in and got made redundant. So that was a second time I fell into the valley, and was quite down. And you know, those initial feelings of that's not fair. Geez, like what a bad rub of the green that is.
Yeah.
And then at the same time,
that's always an initial reaction, though. Or, you know, yeah, and seeing the rest of the world crumble down too, you know. So
yeah, and then I kind of looked at and said to myself, "Well, think about all those people who packed the desks up, and you know what? I'm 21. I've not got a mortgage and a family. I see them, and they've lost their 4,000 or 5,000 dollar a month jobs that were funding the whole life, and now it's just been taken from them." And I looked out and realized there wasn't any jobs in finance for anyone, especially me as someone very new into it. But I looked and thought, they can't just go and get another job. No. So their lives are massively impacted. You know, they might lose the house, you know, relationships might break up, and I'm just here. The only person I'm really reliant on is myself. Mm. And I moved back in with mum and dad, and thought, right, well, I can restart here. I'm not tied down to anything.
And did it affect them much at the time either, like the family unit with the GFC or anything like that, or like apart from?
It didn't, because my dad was at this point working in local government, and my mum was working in childcare. So they were two very, very much shielded industries.
Yeah.
So for them, they were absolutely fine. They continued to work as normal. Yeah. And in a lot of ways, they had purchased the house at a time when, you know, the house prices were low. Their house was worth three times what they bought it for by the time the crisis hit. So they had a lot of equity that had just built up over the years that they've not really aired into.
Yeah.
So
it was the same over here back home. Like we had some, family members where, and I was seeing this across the board. And what it hurt a lot over here, like where we've got superannuation with a lot of, because I don't know if it's the same with the UK, but just where that took a massive hit over here where individuals had years, where they had to keep working, they couldn't retire, so they had to keep pegging along for the next 5 or 10 years just to try and make it surface level again to retire.
Some people did the same thing over here, equity release schemes, because people's houses are fluctuating in value, so people then loaned against the house, where they couldn't get they couldn't remortgage because of their age, so they lent against the house in what was called equity release. So you get a lump sum from your house, but then have to pay back a second loan, second charge over time. And God, that locked a lot of people in because what they lent was knocked off the value of the house.
God, that stings.
So that led them paying back, 10, 15 year loans, 60 plus. And they probably spent that lump sum on maybe improving the house, or doing something to celebrate, or taking a slightly early retirement, and all of a sudden they found themselves consult or try and get back into the workplace. And it's like at that point in your life when really all the language around it, you're retired, you're on the scrap heap, you can't pick up all these new technologies because you and it yeah mm. I mean, massive challenges. But what that actually did for me is it really solidified something as I sat down and reflected about it. That in terms of my career and my professional qualifications, I need to take ownership. Because if I pay and choose a qualification, it's on me. I have accountability to myself. I've got skin in the game. I've paid for it. I've chosen it. I'm going to do it. And no one can take that away. And I kind of thought, I've got this, I've got this entrepreneurial brain that works in those aspects.
Yeah.
How about I set up a company and I'm going to go back into the workplace and try to define exactly what I want to become. If I set up a business, then that will pay me. I can't fire myself. And if it fails, then it does. But learning from previous, the business will have failed, not me. And I can go and start another one. Yep. So I took that and ran with it. And that's where Phenom Games began. So 2008.
Okay, nice.
From my parents' back bedroom, absolutely filled with video games that I'm selling, e-commerce and retail, and it takes off. So I started simply out of the idea that they're easy to post. And I kind of done it before with the Amiga games, like 10 years before. But I didn't need to advertise in magazines now. I could do it through online marketplaces and build a website and use modern technology to get the message out there and not be moonlighting, pretending I wasn't a child, because I wasn't anymore. So, yeah, and that really took off. So that went up to six-figure revenue in the first year, and then doubled in revenue in the second year.
That's great for a 21, 22-year-old, you know, man that's, you know, just come out of uni, and then GFC hit, yep. And then it's all of a sudden, let's take ownership, absolute ownership of who I am. I've just gone through the struggle and sacrifice for uni. You're finally starting to find, you know, who you are, like what you're talking about, where you're starting to, that self-awareness factor, and even more so, bang, Phenom Games. So second year, now where are we going from there?
Yeah, so second year, it doubles in revenue. And what that does is it allows me to buy my first house. So I go and buy my first house and feel incredibly proud, move out of my parents finally. And then I'm still running it out of a bedroom at my new property. And I actually go and work for the local government where my dad works, working in efficiency management. So again, it's much more relaxed working in local government than it is a national bank. So that meant that I could work that job and have that social communication and look to shape elements and understand different industries while running this business.
It's good to have that flexibility too, and also because you've done the type of university degree that you did go through as well. Like that covers a fair few fields there, so.
Yeah, and then I sign up to start doing a number of level 4 qualifications because I decide, right, I need to understand myself better. That's worked for me building myself. So I signed up to do human performance nutrition, spent a year doing that, qualified, and then thought, right, what next? And then decided I was going to do strength and conditioning. So start to understand physiology, anatomy, and how to train the body for performance. Did a year doing that. So now we're into the third year. I'm still in the local government. Phenom Games doubles in revenue again. And I meet my wife, and suddenly life seems to be falling into place in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. So again, I am able to, you know, start paying more off my mortgage than the actual payment. So I'm overpaying on the house. And there comes a point where I decide I've had enough of working at local government. I need a new challenge. I need something different. So I go working on the work program, which helps unemployed people find what industry they want to go into, and then helps them build the confidence and the ability to communicate their skills, passions, and what they can bring in interviews. Mm-hmm. So what that really did is it helped me see that there was a lot of enjoyment, a lot of fulfillment in helping people define what they wanted, mm-hmm. and helping them work and build them up towards getting that. And that, what that really did, it kind of ignited a little bit inside of me about what would then one day become a life coaching and workplace wellbeing practice, mm-hmm. because that process of help you find your path, then help you build you up to start walking on your path, mm-hmm. then help you express that path, and then off you go on your journey.
Holistic approach, like you're covering all bases there.
Yeah, and that just kind of, it really resonated with me. And at this time, I was doing my football coaching badges as my next qualification, just because I like football, and it again helped.
So when you're talking to some of the listeners and viewers,
soccer.
I call it football, but soccer, yeah.
Yeah, so soccer.
Yep, I mean, yep.
There's no Aussie rules over here that I can
Yeah, no, it doesn't exist.
But yeah, and I mean, in terms of what that does is that, again, it just means I'm continually learning, but I'm learning a kind of like a methodology around then coaching other people as a skill-based practice. So something a bit different, again, gives me a different way of you kind of you helping people to adapt and improve in kind of like an educational, but like in a physical manifestation way,
yep.
Which is different again. And we get to 2013, and it's a really big year. So me and my wife get married. We buy our first house. My son's born. So my son, he's now 7. And, you know, he coming along makes me just see the world so differently. And suddenly, like, the responsibility is massive and you start thinking about yourself less and more about your children more. And we cruise around the Caribbean. We go out to Florida on holiday. And obviously life is pretty rosy. And we get into 2014 and Phenom Games is still making a significant amount of money. And I have ended up using these qualifications to go and work in elite sport.
And just thinking, just with Phenom Games, just while I'm thinking of it, because that just sprung to mind, your youngster is only, he's only 7 and you were talking about Commodore 64 as... Has dad showed him a Commodore 64 compared to what an iPad is?
I've not, but he has seen the cassettes.
Nice.
He has seen floppy discs and 5.5-inch discs. And
really?
Lots of the old in my garage, I've got lots of old technologies. What I've actually got is a time capsule that's in my garage.
Nice.
Of all stuff from the first 15 years of my childhood. There's absolutely all sorts of interesting things in a massive box that says don't open till 2050.
Yeah, right.
So I'm gonna give that to him and let him open it in what will be 30 years and just let him marvel over all the things from my childhood.
That's awesome.
And that's just kind of like that's a lovely bit of nostalgia and legacy because I might not be here then. Who knows? Hopefully I will be. But yeah, it'd be interesting for me to open that.
Yeah, yeah.
So then kind of at this point, 2014, I've just turned 29 and my daughter's on the way. So my wife's 6 months pregnant and I'm like, oh, so right, next year I'm 30. My age begins with a 3. I'll have 2 children. I need to be a bit more sensible. Like what crazy things can I do in this next year? And that was all cut short pretty quickly because a week after, my wrist started to swell up and locked in place. And I was like, maybe I banged it, or maybe I just used the computer too much this week. This was on a Friday, and I'm like, if it's still a problem on Monday, I'll go and see the doctors. Then on Sunday, I've gone out for a meal with friends, and on the driving back, suddenly my knee starts to get incredibly hot. By the time I get home, my knee's locked in place as well. And I hobble out of the car and into the house and have a bit of a moment, like,
Jesus.
I can't move my leg. Like, don't know what's going on. So I hobble to the doctors on Monday and I'm like, I can barely move my leg. And look at
was it your joint starting to inflame and lock up or what?
Yeah, so my wrist locked up. So I could move elbow or shoulder, but not my wrist. And then my knee. So obviously I could still rotate my ankle and move from my groin, but my knee, there was no flexion in it, so it had gone.
Yeah.
It just locked in place. It was the size of an Aussie rules ball.
That's huge.
It didn't look great. and
probably as red as an Aussie rules ball too, eh?
it wasn't pleasant. So I hobbled to the doctors, and they give me some corticosteroids and say, these should take the swelling down. If it's still bad in a few days, come back and we'll look at it further, which is probably, given how bad it was looking back, probably not the right advice. But I went home, being a young male, I'm like, oh, they give me some medication. I'm sure it'll be all right.
Yeah.
It'll be fine. Wake up on Tuesday. And as Tuesday goes by, my shoulder starts to swell up. What it does is it starts pushing my shoulder towards my ear like that. So by the end of Tuesday, it starts to raise my shoulder.
Hunchback in Notre Dame, you know?
Yeah, literally. And I just so I went to bed on Tuesday. Like I'm going back to the doctor on Wednesday. This isn't great. Like this is quite painful. So I wake up on Wednesday and my other knee starts to get hot. My mother-in-law comes round to the house, takes one look at me and says, "Hospital, you're just being stupid."
Yeah,
I'm taking you now.
It sounds like your blood or something as well, like has got infections running through.
So what happens? I get taken into emergency at hospital. The consultant looks at me and he just says, "Yeah, take him straight through to the ward." So I'm like, at that point, I'm like, oh, okay, maybe this is a bit more serious than I initially thought.
Mm-hmm.
And then that starts a process of me being in hospital for a month. The damage to both my knees is so significant that at that point I've lost my mobility. So I can't weight bear. I can't walk.
When you're talking about damage, are you talking about muscle tissue damage or
what? Yeah, so my ligaments and tendons had been so effectively attacked because what had happened is my immune system had attacked the connective tissue in my joints.
Yeah, right.
And that swelling had literally caused issues around my tendons, my ligaments, and generally just the placement in my knees to start to be pushed around. And obviously it was incredibly painful. I was on morphine and Tramadol.
Yep.
Take the edge off the pain and also put me onto another planet somewhere else.
Yeah, so, strong stuff. It's gross being on that gear.
Yeah. And I was obviously there in a hospital bed initially, shock hit. So I'm there. I've gone from fully mobile, fully independent, you know, playing team sport, doing anything I wanted in the course of 5 days to not being able to shower myself, not be able to feed myself properly. And again, like you've gone through all this experience yourself, but
yeah,
having that gone over the course of less than a week, the initial emotion was shock. So
I'm hearing you. Yeah.
Couldn't process it. In that first day or two, I was just like, I don't know what's happening, but I just don't feel anything. It's like, what's happened? And that shock started to wear off. Then I felt frustration and despair.
And was it identifiable? Like what the actual, I don't know, if you'd call whatever was attacking your body, was there a name to this thing? Like,
yeah. So what it is, it's a form of autoimmune arthritis. So the best way to describe it is your immune system encodes itself to attack a certain type of connective tissue in your joints, mistakenly thinking that it's some kind of bacterial infection. So your immune system goes off and sees it in your joints and is like, ah, and bang, it just attacks you. So it's incredibly complex. And it's something that what they said is, we could continue testing you forever. But the problem is the treatment for all these things is the same. We use disease-modifying drugs to reduce your immune system so you don't attack yourself. So they were like, we can continue sticking needles in you and testing you for everything, but we don't even know that much ourselves. Tests will continue to develop as time goes by. I've just been tested again 2 months ago with some new genetic testing. They're still not found exactly what I've got, but they said it doesn't matter because all the treatments are the same. But what that kind of led to me is that frustration, despair came after the shock. So I was like, again, like, why me? Like, I'm 29, I'm physically fit, I'm young, I've looked after myself, you know, I don't smoke, I eat well, I don't drink much. Like, this just seems a bit over the top. And then that actually passed, and then grief came in. So I was grieving for my physicality, my mobility.
And what's the timeline not now? Like, yeah, from diagnosis to hospital, or from hospitalization to you feeling this way? Like, where are you now?
It's quick. So 2 days of shock, 5 days of frustration, despair. Then second week, grief and feeling that. And what I knew is, given everything I've been through at university and through redundancy, I'd learned that the negative emotions, don't avoid them, don't suppress them, let them come, express them, they'll pass. You suppress them, they'll come back and bite you down the line, psychological injury, you're just going to save it up and cause yourself problems. So I knew I just had to let it come. And again, we are, as humans, we have blazing joy, deepest despair, and everything in between for a reason. And it's about making sure you express that emotion and find a way to let it come and let it go. Because mm-hmm. there's a reason why you're feeling like that. And so often they try and tell you, oh, you need to be positive, you need to be positive. You're not going to be positive when you feel like everything has just been turned upside down and it's so uncertain and so uncomfortable that you don't have a reference point.
Yeah, and it's for yourself also. Plus, you've got a young family, so yeah. you could have been thinking about that a lot too. Yeah, yeah?
And my son comes to visit and he's looking at me. He's 18 months old. He's not speaking much yet. And he's looking at me like, Daddy, why can't you come and play? he's not old enough to process it. So obviously that just leaves you like feeling like deflated. And my wife's 6 months pregnant. She's still at work, about to finish on maternity leave. And she's coming after work to help me shower, to help me do basic things. It's like, it feels debilitating. It feels like a little bit rubbing away from your own individuality. Suddenly you've had these things taken away. And yeah, I got moved up to a different ward halfway through that second week. And I lay there, and you have so much time to reflect when you can't move and be busy doing whatever you're doing.
I'm hearing you. Like, that's still the case for me. Like, and even, yeah. like, and but, you know, apart from, because with my work, because I work in the disability sector, so I yeah. run my own business. So I've yeah. got, you know, in employees, and I've got, 1,000 things going on, but it seems like the more, like, because how immobile I am, and when I'm laying, you know, because when I'm laying, especially when I'm laying there in bed and I can't move and I can't do certain things, it's just,
yeah,
and things just flood in. But then it's not, the only bad thing is, like, it's a good thing when my mind's going 1,000 places and then I feel like I'm sort of spreading out to things that I might want to jump into. But yeah. the only thing is that I want to touch on as we get into this conversation, the only thing it does disturb is sleep. And then that's the, I'm like, yes, it is awesome that I've got all these thoughts flooding in and got all these ideas, but I don't want them keeping me up till two yeah. o'clock in the morning, you know, which is not good.
Yeah. You kind of you'll feel that acuity when you don't sleep well. It affects everything: emotional regulation, hormone regulation, physiological recovery. It's crazy how much sleep affects.
I know. I feel cheated when I don't get enough sleep, and I know, you know, because I'm a incomplete quadriplegic, so
yeah,
you know, my spinal cord wasn't fully severed. So the only thing, like, I'm at the typical movement level as a C5 C6 quad, but the only thing I can't feel is my right leg. But just, and I know, like, where it can even, because I do have spasticity and where the, like, where my nerves, where they start firing off. And I know if I don't get enough sleep and I don't look after myself appropriately in that sense, my nerves, like, everything will fire off more when I don't want it to. But I just know that I'm not, you know, you got to look after, you know, sleep. Look after upstairs, and doesn't matter if what kind of disability or ability you got, you know, you got to try and look after yourself as much as you can. Hey, so.
Oh, definitely. So yeah. And I mean, I get moved onto this different ward, and I'm looking out the hospital windows. I can see the fields across the road, and I'm just looking out, and I look out and I say, you know what? I need to have a word with myself. Need to give myself this talk, and I need to look and think. I can feel the grief falling off.
Yep.
And there's going to be a point where the suffering becomes a choice. So I need to start to think about recovery and where I'm going to get to. And I then fell asleep, and then woke up and opened my eyes, and suddenly came about. And all of a sudden, a thought popped into my head, and this completely changed the game in so many ways. That thought was really simple, and it was just this one question: have you ever been grateful for walking?
Okay.
In 29 years on this planet, have you been grateful for walking? And it just kind of melted into my mind. And I just realized, never once been grateful. Never once thought, I'm grateful that I can walk. And now it's gone. All of a sudden, you get that amazing mirror to see that actually, you've lost it at this moment in time. You've never been grateful for it before. And that then just, it just kind of transmuted in my head. And then I thought, you know what? Family and friends are coming to help you do the basic things. You can't even go to the toilet by yourself. And yet these people are now giving their time, their energy to help you do the basic things. Have you been grateful enough to them? Realistically, I realized I'm not. I've taken my friends and my family for granted. And then it went even wider. So I was like, I've been brought up in the UK.
I'm feeling you here, brother, big time.
Yeah. I've been brought up in the UK. I've had free education, free healthcare, freedom to set up a business, opportunity to work in a lot of different industries. I've never been hungry. I've never been homeless. And I've got people around me who actually care. And they're here today. I could easily be an orphan on the other side of the world where there's no health provision, where there's no one to help. What would my health outcomes be if I was that orphan? Why the hell am I lying here feeling sorry for myself?
Yeah.
And at that point, I literally sat down and wrote a manifesto. I am going to take ownership of my recovery. I'm going to attack this disease as much as it's attacking me. I'm not going to put any boundaries and limits on my ability to recover. I am going to be proactive in my recovery. I'm going to anchor into the fact that soon my daughter's going to be born and she's going to learn to walk.
Your wife's pregnant at this stage. Sorry.
Yeah. So I'm like, she's going to be learning to walk when she's, you know, when she's 9, 10 months. I'm going to be walking with her. Like, no decision. That's it. Other options cut off. I'm going to do everything I can to get back on my feet. And my identity is going to be running around the garden with my children again. Mm-hmm. And that is going to be what I think about when it's hard, when I'm in pain, when I'm stiff, when I don't want to do my recovery exercises. That's what I'm going to think of. So I was another 2 weeks in hospital, but I was already being proactive, already finding my way to get the physio to come and, you know, see what I could potentially do, like now in a hospital bed, to start the process, trying to get back onto my feet. And I was discharged after a month into walking rehab. And again, yeah, it's challenging. And yet I was resolute. I was resilient. And I had the mindset that I don't know what my potential is. I don't know what my health outcomes are going to be. I'm chasing them. I'm pushing it. I'm going to be consistent.
So you got the timeline. So a month hospital, yeah. and then so you're in a rehab now. Yeah. What's the timeline of rehab, along with your journey of before discharge of rehab? Yeah.
So rehab's a month, and I made really good progress. So again, I'm kind of working with the people that I'm saying, don't put boundaries on me. Don't communicate boundaries or limits.
Okay.
I'm not like any other patient that you might have come across before. I'm me. Treat me like me. And they were. I articulated that respectfully, and they took that on board. There were things such as you come in on the side in, like physically fit and psychologically well and physiologically knowledgeable.
Yep.
So your outcomes realistically are likely to be better because of how you've come in. And also, you know, like
it does help big time. You know, if before you've had an injury or an illness or anything like that, if you're mentally, you know, it might be hidden too, because that's when you have something like this and it's bang, trigger moment. Yep. Let's work. Let's get after it.
Yeah. And I kind of realized that the suffering, it's when you resist the pain. If you let the pain come and use it as fuel, it's like rocket fuel. So I was in rehab, and obviously there's people in there who've had strokes, lower limb accidents and amputees, and people who've you know, had a wide range of injuries that have led them to have, you know, lower limb issues that were causing them to be there with me. And you could clearly see who had decided to take ownership of the recovery. They were sat in that room with the head up, and the ones who were still in that suffering cycle, still hoping that the medication or something would happen that would bring them forward. And they still had their heads down in many ways. And I kind of saw that and looked at it almost as like a little psychological experiment to see who would, you know, who would get moved through to intensive physio and who would be, you know, still there in rehab. And then obviously that a month passes and then I'm passed through to intensive physio. So I spend a lot of time in the hydrotherapy pool, because it's incredibly powerful, where obviously the water takes a large amount of weight off.
Yes, yes.
And starts to really help me kind of build that balance back and build that level of stability. And they kind of look at my knees and say, realistically, you could have surgery and you qualify for replacement, but when you're 30, there's no point there to replace it again in a few years. And if you kind of try and push it as far as you can, well, knee technology itself will be so much better if you can last as long as you can. Because if you can last on these knees for 20 years and push the boundaries, then in 20 years' time, replacement knees will be, you know, 100 times better than what we can give you today. So I was like, you know, I can do it. Things seem to be feeling not as bad. And I start to get a little bit of a gait that's, you know, effective at keeping me bearing weight. And I'm struggling with walking aids because of the damage to my shoulder and my wrist. So I'm really kind of trying to push and hold myself up. And
did you have nerve damage as well? Like, did you have any of that impact?
Yeah, so I didn't have too much nerve damage, thankfully. Because that would have, again, increased the complications.
Yeah.
And obviously, I had that period where it wasn't... to get back on my feet in some shape wasn't that far away from being off. So again, that kind of level of like neurological and muscle memory was still there. I was lucky to kind of harness that. Because obviously, some people 6 months out, that kind of wastage of both, like, you know, the central nervous system and all that processing and the muscular wastage, it makes your recovery more difficult the longer that goes on.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of at this point, 3 months out, back on my feet, and kind of I'm learning to traverse. So we've started to modify the house. I've started to put handles and things I can weight bear and transfer and transverse.
Oh, so you're making accessible around your actual house. Yeah. Yeah.
Obviously I'm having to transfer myself around. And so we start, you know, I get my father-in-law to start screwing handles and things I can balance off. And my daughter's born. I'm there. I'm like, I can't change a nappy on the floor because I can't get back up, but I can, you know, get her onto here. And if I sit on here, then I can still change a nappy. And you start to adapt lots of things. And instead of looking what I can't do, I'm like, how can I do it?
Yeah.
And you start to get that mindset, and suddenly you find that you can find a solution. What was once a threat starts to become a challenge. Like, how can I do it? And again, I'm waking up in the morning. It's painful. I'm stiff. And yet I'm starting to realize that I can be consistent doing these exercises, doing these stretches. And I'm starting to, you know, measure the flexion in my knees and the angles getting better. And then it starts getting worse again. But I'm tracking my progress. So I have a few bad days, but then look back a month before and see how I made progress and feel like I'm still momentuming forward.
And did you have community support from like occupational therapists, physios, and other allied health professionals?
So I had some community support. But to be honest, I was still a young man. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to make my way into the hospital and into physio. Like, I'm going to still, because again, for me, it was more challenge. I realized that I could sit here and have them come to me, or I could see and try to expand myself and get to the hospital. And I was like, you know what, getting to the hospital is becoming quite a day out. And yeah, and in some ways it became a bit of a challenge, but after 6 months, I was back on my feet, but my gait was awful. My gait was poor. And my lower lumbar vertebrae started to compact because my gait was so poor. And again, maybe in hindsight, I was pushing myself a little bit further because I had that kind of that proactivity and that I'm going to do it kind of
feeling.
So I went back into physio and worked on my gait for a month and managed to get a much more uniform functional gait.
And can you explain to listeners and viewers what that is when you're talking about a functional gait, like, so they can get an idea?
So for most people listening to this, you don't even think about walking. You just walk. And for obviously, there's a lot of people here who have been through challenges and understand and navigate disability. And that kind of gait is effectively how you walk. I mean, it's really that simple. And obviously, before injury, I've never thought about how I walk. I just, you know, put one foot in front of the other. And yet, what you start to realize is when you recover, your stepping pattern, how you transfer your weight, because again, walking, you almost think that walking, oh, it's just a leg after a leg. There's a lot of muscular processes. You think about how many muscles are in your leg from significant big muscles. So all the tendons and the ligaments that facilitate that, your hips, your hips, your knees, your ankle, every single toe joint plays a part in transferring that weight. So what happens is you almost imagine what it'd be like if you walked around on your tiptoes for a few months, how that would put so much strain because of the lower surface area that you're trying to transfer all that weight on.
Yep.
That was almost the equivalent of me trying to tiptoe around and not transferring the weight properly. And that caused me to have a certain element of degree of tilt on my upper body, which was then affecting my pelvis and my back. I was putting pressure because I wasn't walking upright, so to speak. And there's lots of different elements because literally I was, if anything, I was walking in a twisted way.
Yeah, okay.
Trying to push that boundary. And that twist was putting a lot of pressure on the lower vertebrae in my spine to the point where it started to press them together. And that becomes really, really painful really, really quick.
Yeah, because that's when you start getting pinched nerves and stuff like that. Yeah. So how long when you're walking around, what would be a typical duration of you're up on your feet? How long would you last for?
Not very long. So at this point, 6 months out, it's about a minute, until I need to weight bear again.
Yep.
So that feels like progress, given that I can actually stand there and weight bear in the first place, and I can actually move.
But, well, it's something.
Yeah, it's something, and it's something tangible to grab hold onto, because I knew that only a few months before, it was like 10 seconds. And then it just all go. So I went back into physio and did a lot of work on my gait and spent a month really ensuring that. I almost went back to do it properly again. So brought the exercises to it more simple, but made sure that everything was as spot on as it could be. And that, again, because I've made progress and because I was really focused in on it, it was quick. It took, you know, 2 or 3 months and my gait was much more functional, much more natural and much more designed for me rather than designed just to be moving. And this all kind of accumulates to the point where after 11 months, I walk myelinated for the first time and I stand by a lamppost a mile from my home, sweating, in a bit of pain, red in the face, but absolutely triumphant inside because I just feel that point. If I can do this, then what other boundaries can I push? Like, how far can I go? And a few weeks later, my daughter starts walking and we walk up and down the street hand in hand and so much comes from that. And some of my friends were like, you only did it because you wanted to beat her. And I look back now and think, probably true, because she's now five and she calls me out for being a hypocrite. She mocks me all the time. There's no way I can possibly beat her on many other players, but at least I can say I was back walking before she was.
That's gold. So yeah. There's that journey of getting through that. You've accomplished, you know, you've sweated it out. You've put in X amount of the miles that you put in where you can walk for so long. And now where is the journey? So you've got to that point. So where's the next? Because it doesn't seem to be any sort of boundaries on where you're going to push, right? So you've got this mindset. You've had it for a while and it's breaking boundaries through this immune disorder that's going on. And so where is this starting to trickle on now? Are you thinking, because obviously to do with work and everything going on, the government job, all of this going on.
Yeah, I've heard that. When I became unwell, I came out of work.
Yep.
And obviously, Phenom Games paid me through my recovery because I was still able to do the digital stuff, which, again, was something I became anchored into and incredibly grateful for.
Yeah.
Because so many people in that experience, once again, you're working a physical, manual job. Good luck, you've just lost all your earnings. And I had two streams of earnings, one of which I could continue. So again, that gratitude, I had the gratitude for the fact that, you know what, I've walked a mile. Some people never get to this point, and not because of the mindset, but just because of the severity of their injury.
Like with that same similar type of disorder that you went through, or do you mean in general or what?
To be honest, I mean more in general.
Mm.
And I just realized that the challenges are there. And my disorder generally hits people. The most popular demographic is ladies who are about 55. So I'm quite rare in terms of like diversity, youth, male. There's not many people who present like me, which was why the doctors were a bit interested in the first place. I've actually gone and done research at university about it because they wanted, you know, different voices, because they put research projects together and it's all ladies near retirement age. And like, kind of saw it and thought, you know what, I'd like to put my viewpoints into the research because I'm not typical in this in this autoimmune arena. I'm quite quite an anomaly to the statistics, and yet I can give data because there will be other people like me out there.
Yeah, that exists, that's for sure, on this planet. So
yeah. So you, I mean, what?
Yeah, sorry, mate. Yeah, just so to, you know, because you say, going back to what you said before, you're grateful for work, you're grateful for realizing this, and especially that you've got this other stream of income. So was that, so you're chipping away because you the amount of physicality that got taken away from you, and you're able to rely on that, which help can, you know, boost you obviously because of the money that it can come in, but also just being able to do something and still be productive. Yeah. So what's, what else is rolling along here?
Yeah. So what I kind of then see is I'm going to keep Phenom Games as it is, keep developing and evolving it and keep agile, but not try to grow it, because I just felt that for me, I just needed the finance coming in. I needed to keep it at a level where I could do it no matter what challenges that I faced. But I made a decision on two fronts. The gratitude front made me decide that I'm going to spend as much time as I can at home until my children go to school, because I know I won't get that time back again. And I know that'll tie into some elements of my recovery, but it'll also mean that I can connect with my children and know that those younger years I was there, and just know that I can enjoy that time, because they'll go to school and then you won't see them as much, and then they'll become teenagers and they won't want to see you. So that kind of, that was a gratitude side, and therefore I didn't actively push being on games to become bigger. And I started to formulate the idea for essentializing that period, thinking that by the time my daughter went to school, I want to help other people who've been in a similar situation to myself. I want to tie together my industrial experience, my qualifications, and my lived experience to be able to deliver something that helps people to define who they want to be, define their authenticity, define a direction to move in life, start to look at aspects such as sleep and nutrition from my own studies and my own experience experimenting on myself, and then start to look at some of the psychological elements. So that became the basic framework for Essentialized that was building in that period.
Yeah, and talking about, like, say, that's it, that's a building, that's the bare bone structure of what's the foundation, what Essentialized is, right? But, and in that foundation, when you're talking about psychology, because when I first saw, you know, environmental psychologist, and I'm like, you know, personally, because I'm like, righto, what is that? It's either, like, you know, first thing that come to thought was, it's people that it's what they're experiencing within their own environment and how they can best adapt within that, or it's within their natural landscape and environment, or, you know, you've got some Dr. Doolittle powers on with, you know, trees and fauna, flora and fauna out there. I don't know, brother. So yeah. So I know it's probably so broad, the spectrum of what this can be, but if you can compartmentalize it, because I reckon it's important from, you know, because obviously I did look into it a bit, and I think it is important what people like yourself can bring to people when it's got to do on the mental health sphere, and not just anything to do, wherever it's got to do with, you know, mental, psychosocial, cognitive. If it's along to do anything with upstairs, I think it's really important. You know, it's not just straight psychology, but, you know, what's within your actual environment, and, you know, how do you adapt, change, evolve? Is that right to say, brother?
Yeah, so I think the way I compartmentalize it for people, because it, when people hear it, they have an idea, but there's three significant pillars. The first pillar, and the pillar I spend a lot of time in, is urban environmental design. So offices, homes, transport networks, cities, how can they be built to influence our well-being in a positive way? And I ultimately encourage environmental behavior in an urban setting. So obviously, as human beings, we didn't move into urban dwellings until a lot later in our evolutionary pathway. So there is design elements and a lot of stuff around how things are designed will influence people's behavior, how they feel, how they think, how they interact. And a lot of my work is within helping offices to build in social design elements, looking at things such as noise, density, ventilation, lighting, acoustics, while also looking at some of the psychological environmental aspects of being in an office space. The second group of my contemporaries look at what you imagine so often is the nature-human connection, but also the human-to-nature connection. So how being in nature is, you know, promotive of attention and can help people reconnect to their own biorhythms and feel, you know, more serenity, more peace, how we can start to access that more, but also how being in nature then makes us behave differently towards nature.
And would you be like, say for instance, if it's someone, if you're looking at design, and if you walk into a building, like to an office with, say, 20 odd employees, 20 to more, 20 to 40, say, and then if you're looking at structure, what it looks like on the inside of their office, but if they've got access to, say, outside and there's a park across the road or where it's got nature involved, do you look at also if it's, you look at the structure of their day. If they work from 9 to 5, yeah. and if they need to get out to expand, like when you're talking about these certain rhythms that are yeah. going through your body and what that, the effect when you go outside and what that, not just physically, but the mental aspect of it too. Is that along yeah. the lines of that? So yeah.
If you can imagine, I'm very like promotive of workplace walks, walking, networking, walking meetings, because again, especially if you can do that in a natural environment, cognitively, you become sharper. As you're walking, you're getting more blood pumping around. It kind of promotes that creativity, promotes a sense of connection. You're grounded in a natural environment, and it does confer a lot of benefits. And so often companies have the access to this right on the doorstep, and they're not utilizing it. And that kind of, again, it's a very, how should we say, multidisciplinary field. So on one day I could be working with like interior designers. Another day I could be talking to architects, and the next day I'm talking to, you know, a board of directors. And then the day after, you're talking to, you know, some chief financial officers. And then another day you're talking to employees, taking assessment data. So you tend to deal with a lot of people on a lot of different levels.
Mm. Yeah, especially when, and do you talk to also to whether it's got to do with, you know, local governments, councils? Like, I'm just thinking it's so important because I'm seeing it in, because I'm 2 hours north of Sydney on the Central yeah. Coast, but I'm seeing it. I've been involved because I got involved with some, had to do with urban design, but I was from the accessibility front, being in an electric yeah. wheelchair. And there's stuff that I know that's going on in the city where they're trying to incorporate a lot of nature within the urban landscape. And I'm like, yeah. that's like, well, I know just what it feels like being out bush. And if you yep. can bring that into the city and not just, you know, the feels, the sights, the smells, like all those. And that's what I love, what you said before, like walking meetings. I never thought of that. Jesus, yeah. like the amount of benefits that people as a whole could get from that. And just that I'm just thinking productivity and where that could spike up, you know, the elements of
oh, yeah.
mental and physical well-being, but also productivity. Big time.
Yeah. And there's a statistic I was looking at the other day, and this is really sad. And it was looking at trees in relation to population. And Australia has a hell of a lot more trees per population than the UK does.
Yeah.
Talking 5,000 in Australia per thousand individuals. Yeah. The UK has 42. if you take the percentages, there's a lot more greenery in Oz per person for you to yeah. access. And
it's a big bit of land over here though compared to
very true.
Yeah, but also like the history of, you know, the United Kingdom and where you guys are and just with, you know, population and growth. But how is it where you are? Because how far, because north of, just so I can get a picture of where Picton is in the UK, in England.
Yeah, so I am north of Manchester and Liverpool. Very much just as the kind of cities end and the valleys begin.
Okay. So it's
very, very green where I am, and very, very wet because we're facing out to the Atlantic. We're about 30 minutes from the Atlantic coast. But what happens is the weather system's blowing off the ocean over the coast, and we're in a valley. So we are just above sea level. So the weather systems blow in and fall into here.
Yeah.
Meaning that it's one of the wettest places in the UK where we're based, but also in the reality, then it's one of the greenest too. And there's wild forests and lots of interesting outdoor places here that we have access to.
That's great.
And it gives a great balance because we're about an hour away from Manchester and Liverpool, which are bigger cities, and an hour away from Leeds to another big city. And yet here, it's very, very rural in many ways.
Yeah, okay. I thought you were because, up that part of England, just like with your Northern English accent, and I was like, I know it's up there somewhere, but where? So, no, well, that sounds great, especially with your youngsters growing up in that part. But also, do you draw inspiration from where you live, being in a green part of England like that, and how you can amplify that out to the rest of not just England, but if it's talking to people like me or other people, wherever it may be?
Yes, in a lot of ways, because of where I live, and when we look at the social demographic and the indices of deprivation, what we see here where I live is the statistics are very high because it's such a sparsely populated but very green and lush place. But only a few miles, a few kilometres away from here, people's life expectancy drops and the life opportunities drop the closer they get towards the cities. And it's something that I'm obviously very passionate about, that we shouldn't have that, lack of opportunity for those people. Again, what kind of happens is we see groups of children, they come from the city and come up to where I am to meet farm animals, to spend time in nature, because they don't have access to it, even though it's not far away. Parents, again, if your parents don't make that active effort because they don't really know about it or recognize it, then the children don't see it, and that then propagates for generations. And again, it's something I'm quite passionate about. And that obviously then again played another part into what I bring through to Essentialize and the workplace well-being side of things. And then you start to see how it all knits together.
Okay. And talking about all of that coming in together, right? Essentialize, where you've got the environmental psychology. And where it's got to do with a lot of the brain health and also design around the open environment and how that best suits individuals. But then if you've got the components of exercise and like a really important component, which is nutrition, huge, and how that affects the system. Like when you've got, you got the mental health aspect of it, you've got the physical aspect of it with exercise and whatever it may be, and then you've got what you're putting inside your mouth, what you're eating and drinking, and how do those three components, and with Essentialize, and what's the importance of those three when you're talking about the physicality and the mental health and the nutrition? When you got the three of those, how important are they? I think I just said it, individually, but as a whole, when you got those three. And sleep. Don't miss sleep either.
Yeah. So what I kind of did is, in that period after I decided I'd stay at home with the kids, I then went and did qualifications in sleep as well, because I realized just how important it was. And I began a mission to try and come off of medication, controlling my disease by lifestyle alone. And that led me to track my nutrition, my sleep, and my movement for years to try and find the optimal point, things that energized me, things that drained me, things I could tolerate, things that set my inflammation off. And I've actually got to that point now. We were with my consultant last month. I came off medication. So I'm now controlling my disease just by lifestyle alone. And I appreciate that for some people, it's not an option.
Yeah.
And yet for me, it became yet another mission to try and push the boundaries and see how much I could decode my own epigenetic expression and microbiome to get to a point where I could start to try and experiment on myself like I was one big science experiment, because we all are at the end of the day. And how that all comes together now is sleep really is the foundation. I've come to realize that the more and more I've looked into it, that
really
sleep is foundational to health and performance, because they're all amazingly interconnected. So if you don't sleep well, you don't feel like moving. So then you don't get the benefits of movement and exercise. If you don't sleep well, your emotional regulation is poor. You get more negative reception, and therefore you're more likely to make mistakes, have accidents, fall into conflict with people, which then all kind of spirals our mood down. It affects our hormones, such as ghrelin, leptin, cortisol, so we feel more stressed.
No, cortisol's huge. Yeah.
We make poorer choices around, you know, the communication that we take. We make poor choices around our food because our hormones are not being regulated. And then we start to see more negativity in the world. So we stop seeing the things we're grateful for and start seeing more of what we fear.
Yep.
The more that we focus on, the more that we get. And again, you eat poorly, 90% of our serotonin receptors are in our gut. So then you start to lack those, you know, neurotransmitters, which means that you then don't get those feelings of contentment and happiness as often. And you start to actually feel like your blood sugar spiked. So it drops your energy off, which then affects your sleep again. More cortisol, less movement. And then that starts to affect the lens, your mindset. And then you start to become less consistent with your positive habits and fall into habits that are negative. And it basically, it just all fuels each other.
Yeah. So like with the foundation, so that's your foundations and how important sleep is. And I know it's important. I know I don't bloody get enough of it. That's for sure. So what's like an optimal amount hours wise of sleep for any individual across the board? And also what's good techniques for someone to switch off at night? Because I know with me, like, and especially if I wake up because I'm a light sleeper, just trying to think of certain things to get me back to sleep, it's not always the easiest.
Yeah. So it's hard to give information because we're all different. We're all very different. So we have our own sleep environmental need and biorhythms and circadian rhythms that affect how we sleep. And yet some of the standard advice that I tend to give is caffeine as a long half-life. So have your last caffeinated drink at 2 o'clock. That will give it the chance to get out of your system because caffeine mimics adenosine. Mm. So it fits into some receptors in your brain. And adenosine is what your body uses to tell itself it's tired. So the buildup of adenosine, it then goes into the receptors. And after 16 hours awake, it's generally telling you, you know, you're pretty tired. Go and get 8 hours to process the adenosine for another day. Caffeine actually goes into those receptors and stops it blocking. So it doesn't give you energy. It just masks your fatigue. And you want your body to be telling itself it's tired when you go to bed in the evening. Mm. When we go to sleep, our core body temperature drops by a few degrees, and that's what drops us into sleep. So try and have your sleep environment as cool, as comfortable for you. Obviously, pajamas, some people without, some people do. Don't dress up like an Arctic hunter because you'll spend the whole night trying to regulate your temperature and you'll sweat and you'll generally wake up and be uncomfortable. So it's about kind of finding that temperature that works for you, the people you're sleeping with. Our skin's photoreceptive, so it's got light sensors in. So have your room as dark as you possibly can. You don't really want to be able to see your hand in front of your face. As we wind down for the evening, try to, you know, obviously block out as much blue light as you can and try to switch off as much as you can. Meditating in the morning helps switching off in the evening. You get more skill at disconnecting. Attempt to use breath work. Breath work works differently for different people, but can really help you anchor in back into your body. Journaling your mind out in the evening gets it onto paper, out of your brain, which gives you clarity and peace. And again, I tend to go walking. That tends to help me process things before I go to bed. And walking at a brisk pace, what it does is it kind of just, I feel emotion and then I feel like I've got headspace to just process. And that allows me to go to bed. But we're all so different.
That's right.
And experimenting. Yeah. But your evening routine is important for your sleep. In some ways, your morning routine is. And don't spend, you know, your last waking hours looking at things that are going to trigger you, looking at the news, social media, your work emails. You need to make your bedroom a place for sleep and sex and not much else.
Yeah. like that's
what it's all about.
Yeah, 100%. And that's where I try, and like when it's got to do with work orientated stuff, where it's just trying to leave that out of the thought processes, you know, but somehow they just seem to creep in, and it's like, oh, you know, it's something that you want to do or something that you haven't got done, or, you know, and the list goes on. And I know there's certain things. I know, well, what has helped, where my wife's put on like meditative apps and music and stuff like that. And when I do try and concentrate, because then it seems like my thought processes and I just gravitated to that more, and then whatever I'm thinking about obviously is left in the dust, and then it's like, okay, then it's like my mind just ends up going, my body ends up shutting down, and in a good way, as in going to sleep. So
yeah,
but yeah, very important.
Yeah, and there's one thing about sleep in terms of looking at it as a foundation, is because you can control your nutrition, you can control your levels of exercise, can't control your sleep. The more you control, the more you try and control it, the more you struggle, because it's one of those few things in life that you don't have control over. You can optimize it, and you can experiment to find exactly what works for you, but you're not going to consistently sleep well every single night, and you actually have to accept that, accepting the fact that sleep is one of the few things that you can't control 100%, and it's more about what you can do to facilitate it rather than trying to control it. Because what they did is, the more they've experimented, if you install the sleep tracking app and it tells you you've slept badly, even if you slept well, you'll trust the data so implicitly that you'll walk around feeling sleepy, thinking that you're tired. And that just shows just how powerful our mindset is on these things, which is why when people get anchored into I must sleep or it's going to be terrible, then they can't sleep.
Yeah, that's true. It's just like trying to go about life without thinking about it, where your body can just fall into a natural rhythm and get the optimal amount of sleep, you know, as long as you can back it up, or try and back it up as best as you can with exercise, nutrition, and everything else that's going to benefit that. Yeah. So,
yeah.
And mate, it sounds like, you know, so sleep foundation, bang. So if you were going to go in order, just of, you know, with going through with Essential Eyes and just what you're trying to promote through there, and with, so sleep foundation, that's very important, because you said that's, you know, there's a certain things that you can control, there's certain things that you can't. So with the things that you can, when it's got to do with nutrition and exercise, so is that where it's with the whole diet aspect, is there anything that, say, nutrition, is it just what's healthy and suits you because everybody's different, or do you sort of go along the guidelines of a certain eating way if it's like keto or paleo or all the other stuff that's out there? So veganism, I mean, whatever, you know?
Yeah, the thing is, nutrition is such a young science. So we've only been looking at nutrition for over 100 years. You kind of take like anatomy, surgery, even stuff like philosophy and psychology, thousands and thousands of years people have been practicing and honing that. So nutrition nowadays is a bit like surgery in the 1600s, where if your leg looked a bit dodgy, they'll chop it off. And the problem is, like, nutrition is full of belief systems, and because of the way studies are at the minute, you can almost back up the belief to eat anything through a scientific study saying that this is good and all the other options are bad.
Yeah.
So it's personal. We're bio-individual. We have our own microbiome, our own gut enzyme makeup. You go and find the foods that work for you and avoid the foods that don't. And you do need to go and do a bit of experimentation. But our body's an amazing feedback loop.
Yes.
You'll know when something tastes delicious when you eat it, but half an hour after, you don't feel great.
That's right.
Body telling you, not great for you. Go and eat something that is going to make you feel better than when you ate it, not worse. And it's kind of looking and realizing that we're all very different in that aspect. Any diet plan you get off the internet is designed by someone for someone else. It's not for you.
That's
right. And if you take ownership of experimenting, because life is a massive experiment. Experiments give data. That data is really useful if you want to try and optimize yourself and get more performance, better health, and simply be a better human being. And a bit of energy to, you know, go and start to look at what you eat and how that affects you.
And change is inevitable too, like where you might be eating that certain way, but there might be something, even if it is healthy, it's going to trigger something that doesn't agree with you, and where you're going to have to, whether if you're, if it's veganism and that works for you, fair enough. As long as you're getting all the work done, bloods and everything through your GP, your general practitioner, doctor, and it works, hey, it works. And that's what I'm all about too, brother. It's like experimentation and, you know, and then if it works for you, you know, that works. But then, you know, change is going to happen. It's inevitable. And we all get older with age. And like I said before, there might be a certain thing that you do eat that doesn't agree, and you know you got to drop that off what you eat there. So
yeah,
but
I almost say that we need to move away from this whole idea of healthy unhealthy, because food can package itself up and say it's healthy, even if it's not. And more so, what's healthy for one person doesn't agree with other people, and it's about finding what's good for your body, because that's going to give you the energy to live a healthy life. And that for you might be one vegetable that, and if another person eats it, it sets off their inflammation. And it's like,
yes,
just because society says it's healthy doesn't mean it's healthy. Like, there's a general consensus that there's a lot of things that are made by food scientists that they're not really going to be healthy for anyone, because they're not even food. They're just imitation food. And yet you just need to play around and find what your body gets the best quality energy from, that doesn't leave you with brain fog, that doesn't leave you with a lag, that just gives you that vitality to go out and do what you do best.
Spot on, brother. And talking about, you know, and some of these foods that, because just sprung to mind then, was some of the meats that are grown in labs. What's your take on that these days?
It's very challenging because
I don't think there's enough research and data and stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking, righto, your research data.
Yeah.
You
know? It's obviously at a very early stage with anything like that. It's very difficult to get any kind of quantitative or qualitative data on what the future outcomes will be. Obviously, the difference at the minute between, you know, something that's very short farm to fork and some mechanically processed meat products.
Yeah.
Well, they're both called meat, but they're very, very different beings. So where does a lovely lab-grown burger fit into there? Well, I'm not sure how it's going to taste if you throw it on the barbie, but is it going to be good for you in the long run? I don't know.
Don't know.
It's challenging. It's challenging, and we will see what happens over time. Obviously, trends move and push science at the minute. So obviously, veganism over the past 5 years has got much weight behind it, and all of a sudden, people are coming up with more and more meat alternatives and that kind of thing. So with nutrition and food, it does move. And, you know, in 10 years' time, maybe there'll be some kind of revolution to something else. Who knows? But it's really about getting out there, trying, and knowing that nothing's so toxic in nutrition that it'll kill you if you have it a little bit.
Yeah.
But in all truth, too much of anything becomes toxic.
That's right. Spot on. So I want to jump back into going back to where, so we've got a bit of a foundation of essential oils there, and where we've got, you know, the environmental psychology. So we got to break that down a bit. So, and just what that is and just what's behind it, where it's got to do with that environmental control and with, you know, your sleep, all the important aspects of that. So I want to just go into what I think is really important at the moment, COVID-19, where it's at a crazy point in a lot of people's, everybody's lives right now, right? Because obviously it's like a second wave of what you've already gone through with the GFC. And I think with mental health, that's gone down big time in a lot of individuals across the globe. And I think it's really important with the work that you've done and what you, when it's got to do with health on all aspects there. And what, like, because you're in a country that's been heavily hit. So how's the current climate of COVID-19 over there? And when you're talking about mental health, because you would have seen it within, in obviously the environment around you, whether it's got to do with personal and work too, yeah?
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it's definitely been a challenging time. And a lot of people have been creative and innovative and managed to find ways to bolster the mental health through these difficult and turbulent challenges that we face. Funnily, there's a lot of different angles I see it from. The people having the autonomy of choice removed on who they see and where they go is like one big environmental psychology experiment that's taken billions of people and been able to enforce a case study, which you simply couldn't do. Mm. So people's environmental stresses have changed, people's environmental contacts has changed, and naturally the ability to connect has become different. A lot more people connecting digitally, but more people connecting with intention. So from a mental health perspective, there's absolutely no doubt that this current scenario is going to effectively trigger like a worldwide mental health crisis over the next year or so. And that's going to manifest itself in a number of different ways. On a simple level, everyone's anxiety is raised in a world where there's something out there that can potentially end our life and end the life of the people around us. And that environmental aspect is massive because now there's environmental cues everywhere, whether it be sanitization stations, station stickers, people wearing masks, barriers and shields. It's everywhere. You can constantly see these little things that trigger your brain to think, some out there that can kill me, some out there that can kill me. And it's like, that is gradually eroding people's mental health. And it's the people who are not being proactive in their own self-care who are going to find it most difficult to, you know, keep that level of stability, because it is incredibly challenging. Those people without the support networks, those people who are already isolated, it's propagated the isolation more. Mm. And for me, in my work, obviously, I look and see the challenges that people face. Yep. Well-being is more important than ever. But what's kind of happened is I do quite a bit of advisory stuff in my work around diversity, inclusion, and belonging. And I'm starting to see that the people who are going to be biggest and widely impacted, the people who have the inclusivity struggles, people with disability, people of colour, women, and people of a lower socioeconomic background. And those people are going to be hit harder, and places need to start looking at, you know, becoming more inclusive to those people, because diversity has increased, but without inclusion increasing as well, people don't feel like they belong. And that is toxic as an environment to be in and presents increased challenges, because again, people in those positions are quite often the most resilient people for all the challenges they've been through, because they've had to climb, submount and overcome more obstacles than a person who doesn't fit those particular categories. And yet they are the people who are, you know, because they're not typical in so many ways, and the world and decisions are not always catered for them, it means that challenges become even higher and the mountains become even, you know, even steeper, because of a world where everyone starts to, you know, focus on keeping themselves well.
Yeah. I mean,
there have been some benefits to this where communities are coming closer together. People
That's
are looking
true.
Out more for the vulnerable. And, you know, there's been a more hyper-local understanding of what's around you. and people taking advantage of the surroundings rather than always being in a vehicle and starting to walk around the local neighborhood and see actually there's amazing opportunities and spaces out there.
Yeah.
But as we kind of wind up, this is an opportunity for people to slow down and reflect from the busy life and see that there is a lot of opportunity out there that you can start to be proactive and, you know, boost your mental health as well as you can.
Yeah.
And hopefully we'll come out the other side. The world will be different, but the world will be a more absorbent place for people to become more well, more included, and live happier and more meaningful lives.
Yeah, well said. And it's so hard when it's got to do with any world leader or anybody running a country to know what to do correctly. No one knows, you know, because when we went through something like this, obviously it was 100 years ago. And like, do you feel like, without getting too political or anything like that, is how's it, do you feel in safe hands when it's got to do with the current government and with Boris over there, with what's going on? And it's going to be, it's a struggle for everyone. So,
it's very difficult to say because obviously they can't generally work in off the data. And when it's such a dynamic environment, it changes day on day. The clarity isn't there and they're kind of making it up as they're going along. In so many ways, you kind of see from different governments, some have managed to articulate things more clearly, some have managed to control things. If you look at Singapore, for example, they've been testing, tracing and tracking from a very early stage, and they've managed to, you know, really transcend a lot of the surrounding countries and not suffer as much. Because pandemics like this is the first time we've had a pandemic in the world of social media and in the world of technology, and we need to be innovative and look at ways that we can utilize that, because unfortunately social media sends a lot of information out there to people that's probably not relevant, and that incites fear and changes people's moods and never usually for the better. And yet we have the technology to look and see how we can start to fight back against these things. And again, some countries have been more proactive, some have not been. And here, we've opened up. I question some of the decisions that I don't think seem logical to me.
Yep.
And yet there's a lot of different influences and pressures from an economic perspective, from a health perspective, from a psychological perspective, and from the advisors and the people who shape policy here. And at the end of the day, it's the people who shout the loudest and the data that shouts and shocks the most that often guide the decisions.
Yeah. And talking about economies, which is like, this is jumping back into Phenom Games, and I'm just thinking that we're all at home now. You know, gaming's huge. So with what you've got going on in respect to that, so have you been getting consoles and games and everything else throughout the door, left, right and center, or what?
There has been some developments over the past few months. I've actually just sold it. So I'm currently sold it, and I've obviously transferred and decided that I don't want to be part of it going forward. Want to put all my energy into Essentialize.
Great.
So it's been something I've built 12 years. It's been part of me, part of my journey. It's become a way for me to walk into an industry and disrupt the status quo. It's been something that's funded my recovery and given me the time and the flexibility to do my qualifications, to shape who I wanted to become.
Yep.
To, you know, purchase and have a life that has been comfortable, and also funded my ability to stay with my children before they went to school. So for me, if anything, it's achieved everything that I always wanted it to and more. Yep. And yet now I feel that supplying video games, it's great. It's constantly changed and I've constantly had to evolve it. It's a lot more merchandise and accessory based nowadays.
Okay.
I just feel that for me, my next chapter is making an impact in the world. I'm not going to make an impact in the world by wholesaling video games, but I can make an impact in the world by taking it centralized and using it as a platform to help people with the health behaviors, to help leaders become more conscious, and to help people build more inclusive frameworks and make communities places where people who are disadvantaged are lifted up. The opportunities are there, and the people are there who for you to look at and think, I can be like them, my own version, and write my own story.
Okay, beauty, brother. So before we wrap it up, I just want to jump before we and before we let a bit of the gaming go. So I just want to know if this could roll on with what you got going on with Essentialize, right? So you got augmented reality, virtual reality. Do you think, and I'm thinking of what, how we're talking now, and I'm thinking, you know, you're on the other side of the world in the Northern Hemisphere, and I'm in the Southern Hemisphere, but I'm thinking of how you can help people with what you're doing, spreading your message. But do you see where maybe that could be brung into the equation there?
So what I see on an initial level is for the environmental psychology assessments, we're already starting to look at VR modeling. So how we can effectively create an office and play around with things in virtual reality and then get people to walk through it and see how it flows, how congruent it is to role, and how they can then adapt. And because again, to fit an office, you don't want to be moving things around. But from a design perspective, if you can take a few employees, pop a few headsets on them and say, walk around this office, see if it works for your role. And that ability to then model that and very quickly change aspects of an environment, see what resonates. That's definitely where we're going and where I'm already starting to look into. But also the principle of coaching in a virtual environment. Because again,
yes,
people into that place, a place where they might be more receptive than the place where they currently are. And actually, that kind of physical connection, if we can start to look at VR in a way that becomes a full sensory experience, where not just the eyes and the ears are engaged, but also start to get engagement from our other senses as well. People are more present, the more there. You can actually bring something more tangible across the world. And there's definitely possibilities there. I mean, it's summer here, it's winter over there, and yet there'll be a time where we can both, you know, effectively be in a virtual environment together, and it'll be the same season. That is not that far away.
That's true. And then who knows when they start, you know, spitting out sensory stuff when it's got to do, not with what you see, but I'm talking about smells, but that'll be a discussion for another time. But brother, before we go, just how can people get in contact with you? I'm talking about social media, or if it's anything to do with Essentialize and what you're promoting there, which I think is absolutely fantastic. So throw it all out in the atmosphere, brother.
Yeah, best places are essentialize.co.uk. My own website at leechambers.org. I blog there often. And also, I'm on all socials at Essentialize Coach.
Mate, spot on. And I can't wait. I know we said it would be a 5-hour alone podcast to do with autism and disability, but we'll park that down the road for another time. But Lee, much appreciated, mate. And thanks for having a yarn with us, and look forward to having another yarn down the line, eh?
Oh, it's been a privilege, Jake. Thanks for having me on, mate.
Cheers, brother.
Bye now.
What a great yarn, eh? His work is really important for the health and well-being of what he's trying to push with environmental psychology. And hopefully with the tech that we've got hold of today, that can make impact of where it can reach people in England, Europe, Northern Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere, and really help people and about just getting through life, especially right now with COVID-19, especially when people are going through hard times and where it really affects mental health. So Lee, I hope that you can really get out there and help a lot of mob. And if you want to get in contact with me, you can get me via Instagram at streetrollingcheetah or email one word streetrollingcheetah at gmail.com. Or also got a Facebook page, Keep Rolling with Jake Briggs. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe button. Be much appreciated. I want to thank our sponsors, Permabil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here. They got great assistive tech also. Toronto. See you on the next one.